You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. Today, my guest is Chris Gove, founder and creative director of Percival Menswear, a London-based brand that prides itself on being quintessentially British. Launched back in 2009, Percival had a series of pop-ups before opening a permanent shop in Soho. The brand has since grown year on year by staying away from the traditional wholesale model and seasonal calendar. Instead, the company releases pieces across the year with its aim of subverting the classics, a tagline Percival says it celebrates by updating and remaking traditional menswear pieces. The brand has a host of notable customers as well, including the manager of England's soccer team, Gareth Southgate, who dressed in Percival clothing during the Euro 2020 tournament. David Beckham and Benedict Cumberbatch are also fans, and the brand designed trousers for Daniel Craig to wear in the latest James Bond film. For this week's show, I caught up with Chris to hear the story of Percival and to unpack his experience in creating a modern menswear brand.
Percival Menswear is a D2C menswear brand. We operate our own online store and we manufacture in London, EU, and a little bit in China as well. With our motto, Subverting the Classics, I guess my mission is just to try and use Percival as a vehicle to get almost the everyday guy to not wear just navy. And we sort of do that by subverting sort of classic contemporary menswear and giving it our version of what we think is a relevant twist, depending on whether it's work, home, loungewear, whatever.
Very well said. Well, we can talk later about perhaps you come around the Monocle office to inspire some guys to move me on Navy as well. A lot of that here. But just walk back for us first. I want to talk about that motto, but how did you get started and why did you decide to create this D2C brand?
Well, it wasn't always a D2C brand. And I guess the business model now was born out of not doing it in the best way in the first place. Essentially, I mean, I was in marketing for 10 to 15 years, permanent and freelance all around London. And I was caught in that freelance life of looking for the next client. And the reason I kept moving on from different places because I just didn't essentially enjoy it too much, putting all my creative energy into working for someone else. And when you're on the creative side in marketing, it sort of exhausts you. And you wonder why, if I could put that energy into something that I owned, that would make more sense. So I was looking for the thing I wanted to do. And I just had a picture of a yellow Rain Mac that I was wearing. I think I was about 4 or 5 in the photo that my mum showed me one Christmas. And I just wanted to make that coat. And I have a few friends who do women's wear design. So they had the technical know-how. I was thinking about this a lot. And then I was doing one job for an agency. And I won't tell you which one, but had a classic accident at work. A shutter door in one of their studios, is an old Victorian building, just came down on my face and I had to go to A&E. And I was in Whitechapel getting parts of my face sewn up. And I was just thinking maybe that's a sign that I should try and do my own thing that I've been thinking about. So I reached out to a couple of my friends and we developed this yellow waxed Mac essentially. It's like a yellow fishing Mac. And I wanted to use sort of some classic waxed cotton. So I reached out to British Millerain, who provide the waxed cotton for a lot of barbers' styles and lots of other brands. And they developed a special sort of yellow mustard tone for me. But there was a minimum quantity order of about 100 meters, I think it was. So I had to buy that. And then I had to make 50 coats with that amount of waxed cotton. And so then I had to sell those coats. And I sold them to sort of mainly my friends. So for a while, there was a lot of us going down the pub all wearing yellow coats. So I'm not sure how that quite looked. And then I had another friend who did wholesale. And he was like, well, listen, if you built a range out, you know, I'd stock this. And so I did. I built out some knitwear and it sort of snowballed from there. And then so the early iteration of the business was a wholesale business model. But that was really fraught because if you know anything about fashion, the traditional business model of wholesale means cash flow is really uneven. So you're selling things in a year in advance at quite high cost, a lot of overheads and a lot of time. And then you don't get paid for 90 days when you deliver the goods in. So I was really working for a year and a half for free. It's my own thing, so I didn't mind. But getting anything done was pretty exhausting. So me and two of the founders, who one was a women's wear pattern cutter and one was in finance because they're sort of the other two wings of the business I needed. We opened a store in Soho. So we had a store on Berwick Street in Soho and we thought, well, listen, you know, it's an advert for the brand, context for the brand. We can start actually sort of selling direct to a customer. And we hadn't gone online at this stage. You know, we're talking, I suppose it must have been sort of 2013 or so, and really hardcore e-commerce for an independent brand hadn't didn't seem that feasible at the time. I don't think Shopify was launched yet, and Magento, after some research, looked too technical, so I didn't have any coding experience. And we had the store for 3-4 years, but I was still in marketing, so I just sort of, it was a hobby job. I'd nip back and forth to the store as and when, just to check in to see if we sold anything. It sort of trickled along. That was okay. And then eventually, I think it was during the EU referendum, one of my friends moved to China, and the other finance guy went into property, and I sort of left on my own trying to run this shop. So I just closed the whole business. And I just happened to have a friend of a friend who sort of owns hedge funds and things like that. And we were just talking about the brand, and he was like, well, listen, the clothes are good, but your business model is just awful. He said, just give it a rethink. What would you like to do? And I thought, well, if I could sell direct to consumer anywhere in the world and just run that online, which in 2017, people had started to do. There's a lot of independent menswear around, but the actual D2C without the support of wholesale, I don't think was that prevalent. And so I thought, if I could just drop a collection every 4 to 6 weeks to have that business model of making in London, making in the EU, because I could manage that, do little collections every 4 to 6 weeks, I can then manage my cash flow a lot easier and own, crucially, the customer data and build out both, meet sort of the data in the middle with my creative thinking, and then hopefully sort of strike a balance. And so since then, we've doubled year on year, and then we've got a main fund investment this year. So now we're really going for it.
Do you think that was a key shift for you in moving out of wholesale and something that's allowed you to not only survive, but to continue to grow?
Without question. Wholesale, I genuinely don't see how that business model works from a margin point of view, unless you are a brand that is extremely premium, so you can fit the margin in and then sell massive volume at the same time. Because the way the supply chain works, the cost of cotton, everything's going up, everything's more expensive. So if we were to wholesale, our goods would have to be sort of twice the price. And so the way the cash flow works is I'm spending so much up front a year in advance. You'd have to have someone with such huge cash flow, such huge liquidity to make that work. I think maybe 20 years ago, that would work because lending was a lot easier. But now I think you need to keep the drop fresh and varied. So you can't rely on 2 to 4 big collections a year. You need to constantly be telling a story. And I think you can do that through dropping little things, being reactive to weather, to climate, economic climate. And if you look at the pandemic, which was a great example of how it just destroyed hundreds of wholesale businesses because all the stores suddenly closed. Okay, there might have been an online, but everyone returned all the wholesale orders. I know lots of friends who have little brands who do operate wholesale models, and they were suddenly stuck with thousands and thousands of pounds worth of stock, and they weren't going to be paid for that. And so they were suddenly trying to pivot to a D2C model. I don't think that pre-pandemic, I'd somehow seen it in a crystal ball. I just felt like that was a more flexible, low overhead, high margin business model that allowed us to weather those turbulent different contexts that can arise. And it was great for us because we were already online. The warehouse is vertically integrated into the business, so we could still pick and pack, even though we went down to minimal staff. There's only like me and two others that were in there throughout the pandemic, but we had a big space, so it sort of was fine. So we could carry on fulfilling, and because everyone was super engaged, conversion was massively high, and that really worked out for us.
It sounds like the market almost helped you dictate what the company structure would be and allows you now to be nimble, as you say, doing small drops here and there instead of quarterly, seasonally, things like that, which is more of the traditional way of the fashion industry. But does that leave you feeling like you constantly have to do something new, constantly have to have a new post, a new update, and a new offering? Who's your customer and what are they looking for in these drops that are coming more often, as you say?
Yeah, a couple of points on that. I think like when you did do the old drop of like 2 to 4 times a year, I don't think we're dropping a massive quantity difference. There's not huge amounts more we're dropping. We're just sort of splitting it up throughout the year, which allows us to just cash flow wise pay for things over longer periods of time. But also I think like from a marketing background, I suppose the ideas are the things you enjoy, and activating them in different ways means that you can creatively satisfy yourself. So say you're tied into a seasonal idea, that's fine, but there's a thousand different ways you can activate that. That's another thing about overheads in fashion. at the end of doing marketing, I worked for GQ Style and did an editorial redesign of that about 10 years ago now. And then I worked for Mario Testino, and the shoot budgets there were so ridiculously huge. And then when we were shooting Percival, I would just get, you know, really competent photographers that I knew to do it for like quite a good day rate. And men's models don't cost as much as women. And so the overheads were really small on shooting. I didn't quite understand why campaigns would be like £100,000 when we were shooting really similar quality. It didn't have the famous names attached, but it was the same quality for like a tenth of the price, not even. So now we have a studio in-house, we have a photographer in-house, so we can create content on the fly whenever we want. And that's sort of part of the fun. That's part of the story and the authenticity to keep shooting, coming up with ideas. If we want to shoot here, shoot there, and it ties into an overarching concept, then we'll just go and activate it. And I think that's what keeps it fresh and varied. So it's the clothing and the content, but that's part of what we enjoy doing. The social media climate dictates that you need to be constantly talking. As long as it's on your terms, I think that's fine.
And I guess that allows you to sort of show off your ethos or how you're reacting or perceiving things. As you say, you can change things based on the weather or the mood. And I find that quite interesting when you're, again, a bit smaller and nimble. Talk to us about how you show off what the brand is about.
One big part of the brand, the subverting the classics, which is what we use for the garment design, but also the tone of voice. I don't know if you remember about 10 years ago, the big beard and sweet back hair phase. A lot of independent brands around that time all got really earnest. I don't know if it's a sense of Englishness that I found quite off-putting. I find it far more interesting if people can poke fun at themselves. I think the zenith of the influencer was around then as well. And it was just so serious. It was just ripe for parody. And so we just started, even with our Instagram captions, sort of poking fun at Blue Steel, etc. And then that has really grown into what subverting the classics means. It's sort of undermining menswear, but still trying to create really well-designed and considered garments. I think those two things actually do work in parallel, and that actually is the Britishness that we try and communicate. So if you look at the last few, you know, fashion films, for want of a better word, that we've done, I just used comedians in them. So we had Sipa from People Just Do Nothing to launch our Champion collaboration. We had Phil Wang and Lolly Adefope in our recent film that was called Watch Out, which was like a parody of 999 with Michael Burke from the 90s. I don't know if you remember that. A guy gets his Casentino overshirt caught in a taxi and dragged around for 8 hours. But it's just far more interesting and engaging if you are speaking on an everyday level, and that is humour. If people are overly serious or overly earnest, I personally find it really off-putting. So that's why we sort of use that vehicle for communication. But it just sits well with me.
Talk to us about some of the pieces. You have mentioned the idea of subverting the classics, but I would wager to say it is a British brand. You've talked about some of the collaborations, but also some of the fabrics you've used. But how would you describe the wares and the pieces that you are designing?
A couple of our sort of signature pieces are looking at classics and then updating them for a contemporary wearer. So our overshirt, which we started doing 10 years ago, really, now has evolved to become this sort of classic work shirt, but trying to use fabrications that you wouldn't usually see. 5 years ago, we're using an Italian mill to develop this fabric. It's called a Casentino wool, which is deliberately pilled. It was invented in the Tuscan Valley like thousands of years ago, and they deliberately pill the fabric so it adds another layer of warmth. But we did a sort of a custom run in this like Satsuma orange and a forest green and a jet black, and it used to just come in tan. That was the traditional color. So it's looking at sort of traditional fabrics and how we can push and pull them for a contemporary audience. Another example is our Sherlock Mac, which is a signature piece of ours that Gareth Southgate ended up wearing for the Euros, just gone. But it's a bonded fabrication, so it's fully waterproof. But on the inside liner, we try and bond colours that you wouldn't usually find. So it's sort of navy on the outside, but we have like this Rioja red on the inside. One has like a lime green. So it's about sort of making it, the exterior, feel like it's contemporary and classic. But when you open it up, you're seeing and feeling fabrications that tell more of an interesting story.
You mentioned Gareth Southgate there, the England coach, of course. There have been a number of notable British celebrities and so on wearing your garments. Has that surprised you at all that people have picked this up? Or is it in that sort of poking fun at what is Britishness that you think attracts, you know, a lot of people are attracted to this brand?
Yes, it is mad that people are wearing it. You know, people of note. I mean, I still find it, even when sales come through, I'm starting to see it more and more, like on the tube and where I live and in London, you just see people wearing, and it is a pinch yourself moment because it's a personal project. For many years, it was just a labor of love. And so when you see people wearing it, I do just laugh. I think the Euros, the Gareth Southgate thing was just mental. The polka dot tie that we created for him, we've never had so much press. And it's just funny that in-house we designed that and now it's just splashed over every paper. Recently, I think a few Hollywood guys have got into it this past couple of months. Like The Rock did a video on Instagram wearing it, and it's clearly too small for him. But I think you can pay people to wear it, but we can't afford that. So they are choosing it. And I think when we speak to the stylists, what they do is they offer up a bunch of stuff and they keep picking ours. And I think it's about, the subvert in the classics comes through in, it's either the weave or the colour or the fabric. It's just a level of interest we're trying to put in, but keep wearable. It is a fine line that I always try and straddle, but it seems to be working.
It's great press, I guess. And on a marketing sense, how do you manage that? You mentioned designing a bespoke piece there. You obviously will be happy to see people wearing your garments. Do you then reach out? How does that work? You obviously don't have the budget or the clout of a luxury fashion house. How do you make that work for you?
I guess we've been around for a long time and not many people know about us. And it does to sort of, I think when you see it once or twice, you make that connection in your mind and end up taking a punt on it. But every situation has been different. With Southgate, the FA hadn't renewed the suit deal with M&S, and so he had a window of opportunity. He just happened to had a couple of pieces of ours and reached out, I think because the Britishness of the brand, homegrown brand, suited probably the press story of the team. A lot of young players in there. So he wanted to have that story throughout, and that's something he really stands for. And then, so when we got invited to his hotel room to do a fitting, we only knew like a week before. So that week was pretty intense. You know, that's the biggest thing we've had. And so meeting him, addressing him, and by the way, he's the nicest guy. Like how you see him interviewed, he's just like that in real life. This father figure emerges and all you're doing is putting a tie on him. But that then snowballs, I think, and then it sort of validates the brand. I think until you get like a validation point like that, people don't really take it seriously. And after that, it's really snowballed in terms of famous guys wearing it.
You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. The second part of my interview with Chris Gove from Percival Menswear is coming up.
Dubai Tourism is proud to partner with The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24. Dubai is one of the most dynamic and innovative cities on the planet in which to do business, and a place where you can enjoy unrivaled quality of life. Dubai should be your destination, whether you're looking to start a new venture or take your career to the next level. Samer Hamadi is the founder and CEO of the Tokyo-inspired pizza restaurant Akibadori. The serial entrepreneur has spent years working in the city's rich nightlife and hospitality scene and says it is the perfect place for him to grow his business and raise a family.
Well, the best part about living here, now that I'm a dad, I would say is the safety aspect. I can't imagine raising my kid in too many cities around the world that give me that sense of safety and security like Dubai does. So, in terms of running a business here, I'd say the access to talent. People want to move to Dubai. It's always, you know, been a very aspirational city. So that helps us a lot with recruiting the right people for the different businesses.
Samer Hamadi there. Dubai, the future of business is here.
I'm curious about the relationship with your customers and the people that are brought into your community. You started out by having the shop. People could walk in and find it that way. But we're in a totally different ecosystem now where you could have a permanent shop, you could have a pop-up shop. But of course, there is social media, there is online. So people are coming to you in different ways, but you also have this amazing direct contact as well. I'm curious what people are looking for in a menswear brand right now. Is it in the quality of the stitch and knowing about where the fabrics are coming from and where it's made? Or what is it that draws people in, do you think?
We try and realign on this a lot because you've got to understand the consumer. And we're definitely not big enough to sort of get out of touch, but I think you've got to stay on it. But for us, I think it's portraying a level of authenticity. I think when you see a big brand try and do like a rebrand and they start trying to inject authenticity or some local stories, you can just see through it. So I think when we put our team front and center of the brand, what we're communicating is that we are a small brand, we are independent, everyone's just working hard to make the best product they can make. And I think there's a lot of our customers from the very beginning. 10 years ago, when I just did pop-up shops and we had that store in Soho, a lot of them are still around, and so they've loved to see it grow. But even though we are a lot bigger, me and the guys here, our marketing team and social, we are all just kicking about the store, the studio. People know where the studio is, so it's not necessarily an open door policy because you've got to get work done. But people can contact us in lots of different ways, and we are there to just talk to them. So we're still at the level where we just have direct line of communication with all our customers. And that's really, really important.
I'm curious about what you're seeing in, we can say, trends, let's say, and how people are wanting to dress. Obviously, we came through the pandemic where some people might have thought men would be dressing casually and working from home and wearing sweatpants and things like that. But what are you seeing in the way men want to dress these days?
Yeah, there was a sweatpant phase, wasn't there? That loungewear phase. I don't think that's gone away. I think jersey is now, you're getting better quality jersey at higher prices. And there's some great jersey brands now. I don't think that's going to go away. That jersey, track bottoms and hoodies has injected itself into contemporary men's fashion and is now really acceptable. I think obviously the casualization of the office is now, you know, it's never been more casual. And I know for a fact that unfortunately, like Savile Row is really struggling because that smart market, that suit market, that dresswear market has just dropped off because no one is wearing suits to work anymore. I mean, I think there are probably are some, you know, financial institutions that still demand it, but it's getting more and more casual. And so what we're really seeing now is a huge diversification across the demographic of sports mixed with contemporary men's. It's totally acceptable to wear a really nice raglan wool car coat with a pair of nice jersey track bottoms. It's really acceptable to wear an amazing double-breasted trench with a pair of Nikes. And so it's about balancing those styles, but then how that defines your own brand. You know, for us, the work shirt is really key. The Sherlock is really key. Our knitwear is a massive part of our brand, but that does need to style in well tonally with all these different touch points. It's kind of amazing fashion now. You look on the high street, everyone represents a nuance of their own interpretation. And I don't think you could say that even a year ago.
If we talk about being a British brand, I guess there is a window for you there to not just educate, but carry on being a flag bearer for Made in Britain or styling done from right here in London. Obviously, there are those staple pieces you talked about. Is it important for you to sort of educate people on that, not only the tradition and moving it forward, but sort of these staple wardrobe items?
Yeah, I think the view we take is that, well, it's the navy thing for us. So, for example, I always try and find the new navy, which sounds crazy. Like, what's the new black? But for there's so many men just wear navy. Navy's great, but a lot of guys will stop buying stuff because, oh, I've got that, I've got it in navy. When actually a forest green, for example, over this past year we've noticed is the new navy. Like, a lot of guys will take a punt on a nice deep forest green because it just says something slightly different and does look amazing and compare with so many colours. So we're trying to show how you can style in these different colours and textures with what you currently would wear. There is like a big fashion audience that we have that are really clued up and will totally take a punt on any sort of colour because they know how to style it in. But I think that casualisation of the office, those guys who are coming from that suit world, that will just auto to navy. Our feedback usually is, you know what, I wasn't sure about this when I bought it, but all I do is get compliments and now all I do is wear forest green. Well, then you've got a different problem on your hands. But when it comes to the manufacturing side, I think we're not like made in England flag bearers necessarily. You know, the reason I started manufacturing here is because I could cycle down there and quality check and cycle back again. But the truth about made in England is it's really difficult to manage and it's really expensive. It is dying because it's the cost effectiveness isn't there. And we're one of a few brands that will make here and we will continue to make here and try as much as we can. But I don't have the money to sort of make everything here. It doesn't make sense to because now we're out of the EU, I can't import a lot of fabrics. It just wouldn't be cost effective, and that's the truth. It's just natural that we're going to keep a couple of styles here forever, I hope, and then continue to work with the EU as much as we can.
How prohibitive has that been? Obviously, the last year and beyond post-Brexit has been difficult for lots of industries. But talk to us about your experience and how that has sort of shifted what you've had to do, as you say, maybe thinking about different fabrics or different manufacturers.
The initial issue was shipping to the EU from here. So obviously they levy quite heavy charges. And because, you know, we think about the EU as one, but now our relationship border-wise is different with every single country within the EU. So that's been the issue. It's okay, you can import to Spain, Portugal, Austria, Germany, the Nordics, but each one levies a different tax depending on the content and depending where it's made. So just from a bureaucratic level, getting things to customers was initially a real nightmare. And so what we did was use DDP, which is duties paid. So we just paid everything up front and took a massive hit on the margin, but the customer could still just get it. But that meant it hampered margin, so costs have to go up. And then importing things, so a lot of our Italian fabric that we would make here, so Britain wants to now charge loads for that import on the basis that we should get fabric made in England when there's hardly any fabric left to be got here, apart from there's some good Irish and Scottish tweeds and wools, but if I don't want that, then where do I go? So then we had to then make those things I would have made in England, in Portugal, or in China, and then import them. And so actually it pushed us to China a lot because we could make the duties on importing from China were a lot lower than even the EU. And so we were just dictated by the government's choices. And I think it was a bit of a tit for tat as well, because, you know, it wasn't until, I guess, the middle of this year where the borders in different countries actually sorted out the bureaucracy of importing, because all the rules changed again. We now use these HS codes that we didn't even have in January. So they're like everyone else. They're businesses with all their problems, and they're finally getting there. But it has been an absolute nightmare.
I'm just curious where you're at now with the company, obviously heading up to Christmas, a new year ahead to think about. We talked about the idea of reacting to the market and to the consumer. Where are you at these days, and what's on your plate? What's happening at the studio?
The studio's buzzing. We've now got a couple of embroidery machines. We do a lot of embroidery. It's one of our signature things. So we're playing with some new technology there. We've just overlaid a load of tech onto the site so we can start delivering different languages. But yeah, Q4 is always crazy, and the Cyber Week madness is sort of finishing. We're questioning whether we even want to do it going forward. I think as a small brand, you can't really miss sales. I'd love to have a holier-than-thou Instagram post and say we're too cool for Cyber Week, but the reality is I don't know what the future holds. I think e-com's obviously getting stronger and stronger, but I think the high street's coming back as well. But I'd be interested to see if there's any sort of Cyber Weeks or Black Fridays next year. But yeah, we're introducing some new lines, developing some shoes, trainers, and some technical wear. So just expanding into categories we don't have. So yeah, just plowing forward.
And for you, I'm curious how you are enjoying this journey still, and how it has been to sort of grow a brand that began as a bit of a side hustle, as you talked about earlier. Where are you at, and are you surprised at how far you've been able to grow this company?
Yeah, massively surprised. I think my view on it always is we'll quit and close the business if we've not hit what we want to hit over the next 6 months. And if we don't, you close it. And that's always been the mentality. If you haven't made a good stride forward in 6 months, then what are you doing? Because I definitely don't just want to grind for the rest of my life. You know, the business a year ago only had 5 people. Now it's got close to 20. And so this year has been a massive learning experience for me in terms of the bigger you get, the more you end up managing people. But I'm quite happy to do that. It's just making time to make sure you are designing, keeping an eye on the creative. That's the reason you start it, you know. And there's a sweet spot where you get to do that. And hopefully that carries on for at least another year. But the idea is to get big enough so I can just do that and not have to manage anyone. But it's just the realities of business. You know, you end up running a business and that's what you end up learning. Yeah, it's ever evolving, but I'm always ready for the challenge.
What's the most exciting part about it for you? Is it still being involved in those designs and sort of trying to react and come up with new interesting pieces?
Yeah, the two sides of it are designing the garments and then activating them. So I love, just once you've designed something, we go through that sampling process. When you see someone wearing it, it just validates your idea. There's nothing worse than sort of Emperor's New Clothes where you think you're doing all this amazing stuff and it doesn't actually sell or someone doesn't wear it. But we get it right most of the time. Hopefully we can carry on doing that. But yeah, when you design something and you get all the way through to shooting it and the end product does look good, which doesn't always happen, but when you nail it, it's just the most satisfying thing.
Very, very well said. Well, Chris, thank you for your time. I really appreciate hearing about the journey. It's been really fun following along with Percival Menswear. So we wish you the best of luck going forward, and hopefully we can check in again.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's Chris Gove, founder and creative director of Percival Menswear. You can learn more and shop their collection at percivalclo.com. That's it for this week. My thanks to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.